Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86803, Michael Booz versus Marion S. Berry.
Right here.
Get out here as quick as I can.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Mr. Bertacci, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case involves the constitutionality of both clauses of a District of Columbia statute initially enacted by Congress in 1938. After stating the case, we propose to divide our argument into three parts. First, we contend that the first clause of the statute, which prohibits the display of specified flags and banners, violates the free speech guarantee of the First Amendment. Second, we contend that the second clause of the statute, which gives the police the power to disperse congregations within these 500-foot zones, violates the First and Fifth Amendments. Our third and narrowest contention is that both clauses violate equal protection because the legislature has allowed parties to labor disputes to utter precisely the same speech and engage in precisely the same conduct that petitioners cannot. The facts are simple and relatively straightforward. Petitioners are three young political activists. Each wishes to display signs containing messages critical of foreign governments and their policies and views on the public streets and sidewalks of the District of Columbia within 500 feet of the official government buildings they wish to criticize. For example, some of the petitioners wish to display a pro-Sakharov or a pro-Solidarity sign on Sakharov Plaza in front of the Soviet embassy. One petitioner wishes to display the American flag there. Another one wishes to display a Stop the Killing sign in front of the Nicaraguan embassy. Each petitioner also wishes to congregate with two or more other people within the 500-foot zones. And each petitioner is prohibited from either displaying signs or flags or congregating by Section 1115 of the D.C. Code. There are numerous cases pending in the District of Columbia courts involving prosecutions under both clauses of this statute for displays of signs in congregations at the Soviet and Nicaraguan embassies. This is a 1983 suit that was instituted in the district court seeking declaratory and injunctive relief. The district court, on cross motions for summary judgment, upheld both clauses of the statute and dismissed the complaint. The Court of Appeals affirmed. The Court of Appeals in 1973 in the Zimy case interpreted the first clause of the statute to apply only when there is a, quote, display, unquote, of a flag or banner that produces one or more of the enumerated consequences specified later on in the first clause. In this case, the Court of Appeals, perhaps narrowing that definition further, construed the first clause to apply only to demonstrations in which signs are displayed designed to bring foreign governments into public disrepute or public odium. So far as we can tell, neither respondents nor the federal government challenged that construction. In other words, under the first clause, the only thing that is proscribed is the display of a flag or banner or sign designed or adapted to bring a foreign government into disrepute. We note at the outset that under this construction of the first clause, no violence is prescribed. It's not illegal for petitioners to demonstrate or for anybody else to demonstrate. It's not illegal under the first clause for anybody to engage in any violent conduct. There is a reference and maybe several implications in the brief of the respondents in the United States suggesting that the first clause serves an interest in protecting the security of foreign persons and property. The Court of Appeals itself acknowledged that, in fact, the security interest asserted by the government in the court below was insufficient to justify the first clause. According to the Court of Appeals, the only conceivable interest that would sustain the validity of the first clause over a First Amendment challenge was the governmental interest in protecting the dignity of foreign persons and properties. The essential holding of the court below was that a dignity interest on the part of foreign governments and foreign persons, by dignity interest I mean an interest in avoiding peaceful political insults, was not only a legitimate governmental interest, but an interest sufficiently compelling to override petitioners' claimed First Amendment rights. With respect to the second clause, the Court of Appeals narrowed its terms. The second clause on its face gives the police the power to disperse any congregation within the 500-foot zones and sets no limits whatsoever upon that dispersal power. The Court of Appeals read the dispersal power as limited to those circumstances in which the police reasonably believe a threat to the security or peace of an embassy is present, and held that so limited, the second clause suffers from no constitutional infirmities. In our view, the first clause violates the First Amendment for several separate and independent reasons. We note at the outset that what is involved here is political speech on traditional public forums. Petitioners wish to speak out on interests on issues involving foreign relations, which are of the utmost public concern. They wish to do so at the seat of government, and therefore, in our view, this case involves the exercise of First Amendment rights in their most highly protected form. Our first contention in this regard is that the first clause violates the First Amendment because it is viewpoint discriminatory. The first clause does not prohibit any and all displays of signs and doesn't prohibit any and all displays designed to communicate ideas. The only displays prescribed by the first clause are those which are designed to bring a foreign government or its acts or officers or views into public odium or public disrepute. In short, Petitioner Brooker can stand in front of the Soviet embassy and wave the Soviet flag. She can't wave the American flag.
The government says that that's not a viewpoint discriminatory on any basis established by the government. It's simply the policy of the particular embassy in question. And I think also they say that there aren't a lot of people standing in line waiting to wave an American flag in front of the Russian embassy, that this statute addresses things that actually happen, not hypothetical situations.
Well, if I can take the first part first, Mr. Chief Justice, this statute does prescribe an acceptable and an unacceptable point of view. If someone stands in front of any embassy with a message designed to disagree with the acts or policies of a foreign government, that is prescribed. Of course, the prescription depends in part upon a policeman's judgment as to what is designed to criticize a government and what is not.
But it's not enforcing a governmental point of view on anyone. Not on the United States governmental point of view on anything.
Well, the United States governmental point of view, mandated by Congress, is that views critical of foreign governments are illegal, but views supportive of foreign governments are not. That governmental view is embodied in the first clause. As construed by the Court of Appeals, someone could stand in front of the Nicaraguan embassy and hold up a sign saying, "We support Daniel Ortega." But if one word is changed on the sign and the message is we oppose Daniel Ortega or we oppose the Contras, that is then prescribed and becomes a criminal offense. So in our view, the statute is viewpoint discriminatory in a very specific sentence. In some cases, the court has indicated that mere content-based laws, as I understand that term, it means a proscription of speech on all subjects except religion, for example, or all subjects except foreign affairs. A mere content-based distinction is, if not a per se violation of the First Amendment, one that raises serious constitutional questions and requires a compelling governmental interest in order to be sustained. In this case, we have a narrower prescription. This statute doesn't prohibit all speech on, doesn't prohibit speech only on the subject of foreign affairs. And in fact, singles out particular points of view.
But it doesn't prohibit speech anywhere else in the District of Columbia, con or pro on these things. It simply prohibits a particular kind of speech in a very narrow place right in front of a foreign mission.
Well,
you can go anywhere else in the District of Columbia and say anything you want about the Nicaraguan government, pro or con, or about the Russian government.
That is true. The statute applies within the 500-foot zones. I don't think it's fair to say that it applies only in front of these buildings. The statute applies for a radius of almost 2 football fields around every foreign building in the District of Columbia. It's also true that the statute is irrational in other ways. There's no prescription against speaking.
Are you suggesting that if the statute had just prohibited a lot more speech, it would be fair better under the First Amendment?
Not at all. No, I make that argument only because it buttresses our vagueness contention, and also shows, in our view, that the statute is arbitrary in terms of the way it is both enforced and written. No, we don't contend that a statute that prohibits more speech would be better than this one. We contend, that's not our position. Our position is that by discriminating between viewpoints, the statute essentially legitimizes censorship. That's the position. Now,
well, what if it just said no speech, no signs at all within 500 feet of an embassy?
Then the statute would not be vulnerable on the basis of a viewpoint discrimination or censorship attack, but the statute would, in our view, be invalid because of its overbreadth. If the statute said, and even as it's written, the statute does say, there shall be no criticism of foreign governments, at least on picket signs, anywhere within 500 feet of the official buildings of those foreign governments. That statute, as written, prohibits any kind of speech anywhere within what amounts to insult-free zones that cover a substantial portion of Northwest Washington, D.C. In this connection,
each zone covers a different insult, right? I mean, it's
each zone covers a different insult-free government, correct? But the effect of that kind of an application of the statute is to insulate foreign governments from insults against them throughout a substantial part of Northwest Washington.
That isn't entirely correct. If you're talking about the Russian embassy, for example, they are insulated within a 500-foot radius of their own building, which is a tiny fraction of the area of the District of Columbia and a small fraction of the area of Northwest Washington. And that the same is true of every other embassy. It's just when you lump them all together in a way which doesn't really make much sense constitutionally that you could come up with the sort of analysis that you do.
What you say is absolutely correct, Mr. Chief Justice, except that in the view of these petitioners and many others who depend upon effective picketing to convey their views, if picketing is going to be effective, it has to be carried out somewhere where the message conveyed has some meaning. If people stand 2.5 football fields from the Russian embassy and are in front of a faceless office building and hold up a sign criticizing the Soviet Union, the effectiveness of that message is substantially diminished. And the likelihood that
the Constitution gives them the right to have the most effective possible situs for their message?
Absolutely not. No, our contention in connection with an overbreadth argument is narrow. It is that, A, this statute prohibits only expression and no conduct. That is, it prohibits what is most protected by the First Amendment and doesn't prohibit what the government has a most legitimate interest in outlawing. And secondly,
violence is that?
This statute does not prohibit violence.
But aren't there other D.C. statutes that prohibit violence?
Yes, and that's
does
precisely...
Does the government have to put every single prohibition possibly applicable into the same statute?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, but that's exactly our point. Our point is there are other statutes that prohibit violence and untoward conduct. And the government's interest in prohibiting that is fully satisfied by those other statutes. This statute prohibits only speech, the first clause. And unless the prohibition of speech is a legitimate governmental interest, there is no reason why this statute should remain on the books. I'd like to go one step further and briefly mention our additional contention that the statute is overly vague. The only criticism that is prohibited by the very words of the statute is that which is designed to bring a foreign government into public odium or public disrepute. Does that prohibit only the severest criticism or mild criticism of any kind? To state it differently, does this statute prohibit only that kind of vigorous, robust, wide-open criticism that has been constitutionally protected at least since New York Times against Sullivan, or does it prohibit even the most mild-mannered, gently conveyed political difference of opinion that's been constitutionally protected since day one? The answer, according to respondents, is it prohibits all criticism. Well, that, in our view, serves to accomplish two results. First, it dramatizes again the sweeping overbreadth of the scope of the first clause. Secondly, it makes the statute vulnerable because, as applied by these respondents, it's being enforced arbitrarily and discriminatorily. The record, it not only...
For us, is that included in your petition for certiorari?
Yeah. The issue, it's encompassed within the issues, in our view, Your Honor. We made that point in the petition.
But do we have anything in the record that goes to that the Court of Appeals passed on?
The Court of Appeals noted this in the footnote.
Yeah.
Yes. We believe that the fact that the District of Columbia government and the respondents are letting thousands of people violate the statute at the South African embassy with impunity, but on the other hand are prosecuting everybody that demonstrates at the Soviet or Nicaraguan embassies, is relevant in two different respects. First, it shows that the potential for arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement of the laws, which is an important consideration in any vagueness context, is not a theoretical one, but an active fact. Secondly, in the equal protection context, to the extent the government argues that what's at stake here is a compelling governmental interest of great constitutional magnitude, it's relevant in that regard.
I frankly don't see which of your three certiorari questions you think presents that issue.
Does it violate the First Amendment, Mr. Chief Justice? The first question. We challenge the statute on vagueness grounds, and the court...
Discriminatory enforcement?
Yes. As we read Colander and many of the other vagueness cases, a primary concern in the vagueness context is the potential for arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. In our view here, we have not only the potential for that, but the reality of it. But also, just from a legal standpoint, in the equal protection context, the government's answer to our argument essentially is that the insult-free interest is one of great constitutional magnitude, a paramount value in our constitutional scheme, and in response to that, it is relevant for us to point out that the record belies that assertion. If this interest is as paramount as the government contends, then how can it be that at the one place in the city of Washington where there's been a great deal of exposure and where our activities are more visible to the world at large than any place else, at the South African embassy, they've let everybody violate the statute and get away with it? That certainly is relevant to whether the asserted compelling nature of this interest is in fact as important as the government suggests or whether the record belies that assertion. If I may, I'd like to turn to the grounds upon which the government attempts to defend the first clause. The first interest asserted is the dignity interest. As we understand the government's position, there's no dispute that this clause cannot be sustained as a reasonable or valid time, place, or manner restriction because it is content-based and therefore, by definition, not a valid time, place, or manner restriction. The government's position is that the first clause serves to further a compelling governmental interest and is narrowly tailored to accomplish that end. The compelling interest is the so-called dignity interest. Again, the dignity interest asserted by the government is not an interest in the context of speech or the style of expression. It's not the difference between speaking through a loud speaker system and conveying messages in a more delicate way. The interest is an interest in avoiding political disagreements or political insults. In our view, in the simplistic view we take of this issue, the argument that the avoidance of political insults is a compelling governmental interest which can override First Amendment rights is a contradiction in terms. So far as we can tell, even though the Article 2 makes the President the Commander-in-Chief, it's clear from the Court's prior decisions that members of the public have a right to politically criticize the President for his conduct in office. Ever since Bridges against California through Landmark against Virginia, it's been established, as we read the cases, that ordinary members of the public have a right to politically criticize or otherwise criticize judges and justices for the way they carry out their duties. As from, on the basis of what we understand about the adoption and ratification of the First Amendment, it seems difficult to believe that those who wrote and ratified the First Amendment intended to empower the Congress to enshroud political opponents like King George or other royal leaders in an envelope that immunizes them from criticism. There was no reason 2 centuries ago why foreign leaders around the world should be protected from peaceful free speech by American citizens. And if anything, there's far less reason now, as a practical matter, in today's world.
Well, only in their embassies. I mean, you can criticize King George anywhere.
Well, that's true, but that cuts two ways, Mr. Justice. In this connection, we are addressing the legitimacy of the insult-free interest. If the insult-free interest is a legitimate one, for governments and for foreign officials, and if it's sufficiently important to override First Amendment rights, then at a minimum it should be applied even-handedly. It's not applied even-handedly. It's applied to people who depend upon picket signs to convey their views. It's not applied to others who own newspapers or own television stations or who are even able to speak orally within the insult-free zones. Yes, it is true that political insults are permissible everywhere outside the zones, but people have a right to be on the public streets and sidewalks in the District of Columbia.
Really contend that the statute that your argument would be cured by a statute that prohibited insults in all media that are available to the audience?
If I said or implied that, I certainly didn't mean so.
Well,
absolutely
you're
not.
Implying it. Why is the statute any better by suggesting that? What is your answer to that? I don't understand.
Could you ask the question again, Mr. Justice? I'm not sure I have it.
Justice Scalia asked you about the discriminatory aspect. You said, well, it's bad because it's discriminatory. It only interferes with people who just have the means to carry a banner around in front of the embassy. And the cure to that would be, if your argument is valid, to ban it to everybody who wants to insult the ambassador.
I may have been addressing a narrower point than I should have. The insult-free interest is not legitimate anywhere inside or outside the zones.
And the statute would not be improved by broadening its coverage.
It would be made worse. It would be made more vulnerable to an overbreath attack. But if
there's no equal protection problem here. I mean, the one-step-at-a-time approach to eliminating problems is well established, right? You can reach some of the evils without having to reach all of the evils, can't you?
That is not the way we read this Court's equal protection decision.
So you are saying, then, that this statute would be better if it not only prohibited the picketing with signs within the 500 yards, but also speaking or anything else. That's a vice in and of itself, that it doesn't extend broadly enough within the 500 yards.
I certainly don't mean to convey that implication. This statute is bad, A, because it discriminates between points of views or between speakers, but B, there is no right to prohibit anybody from speaking on political subjects at any time within these zones where people have a right to be and to speak.
All right. But you don't say, C, if there is such a right, you can't apply it just to signs and not apply it to speaking. You don't say C.
That's not a major.
See, I thought you were saying C, major or minor. I don't care. You're not saying C at all.
I'm saying that further demonstrates the irrational way in which.
So you are saying C.
I am saying that that is a fact, not a major contention. Yes.
It is a minor contention.
It is a matter which, upon which we rely.
You want to assert C or not? Just tell me. You want to assert?
No. But I'd like to make this clear in case I haven't. The equal protection claim we make is based upon the labor exemption in the subsequent statute, that is Section 1116. The argument we make with respect to the viewpoint discrimination is essentially a First Amendment argument. And that argument is some people, whatever they may happen to be, can go over to these zones, can hold up signs expressing one point of view, it's permitted. If they express a contrary point of view, it's prescribed.
Then you cure that by saying no signs at all, and you say that's worse. Your real argument, if I understand you, is that the fact that the listener or the audience doesn't like what you have to say is simply not an acceptable justification for prohibiting speech. That's your whole argument.
Well, it's certainly an important one, but yes, we make that argument. But
do you make any other argument? I don't see it if you do.
Well, I'd like to address the equal protection questions just to make sure that there's no misunderstanding about this. The equal protection claim is based upon Mosley and Carey and relies upon a later exemption in the statute. The equal protection claim, qua equal protection, is based on the fact that the legislature has said, even within these zones, anyone who is a party to a labor dispute can perpetrate the insults or engage in the conduct that's otherwise prescribed to everybody else. The equal protection argument presupposes, unlike the First Amendment argument, that it would be legitimate for the legislature to enact an all-out, all-encompassing ban on speech. But even in that narrow context, if the legislature allows someone to enter the zones and utter insults under Mosley and under Carey, everybody else has to be allowed in. If I haven't made this clear, I want to make it very clear. We are not conceding in any way in a First Amendment context that it is proper to prohibit anybody from engaging in political free speech on any of these streets or sidewalks where the public has a right to be and which are traditionally used for expressive activity. Briefly, I'd like to mention, again, in response to the dignity interest claim, the existence of the federal statute nationwide, which has fulfilled for the past decade or more the government's interest in ensuring the dignity and peace of foreign embassies throughout the United States, in all of the 50 states. In connection with that statute, the Congress in 1972 imposed a ban on picketing that was content neutral. In 1976, it came along and repealed the ban because of its concerns that prohibiting this speech was a violation of the First Amendment. If Congress has implemented treaties entered into by the United States and concluded that peaceful picketing is not something which it can constitutionally prescribe in any of the 50 states, in our view, it follows that the insult-free interest is no more legitimate in the District of Columbia. I'd like to mention just briefly our claim with respect to the second clause. The second clause, on its face, I think even respondents concede, is overbroad. It gives the police completely limitless power to order dispersals of any congregations within the zone at any time. The Court of Appeals narrowed the second clause. In our view, it should not have done so since this clause.
Did it narrow it or did it interpret it? Which do you say?
I think it rewrote it.
Yes, and you think it didn't even it didn't have the authority to do that. I suppose that is that one of your contentions?
Yes, Mr. Justice. But in the
even though the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia could have,
as I understand the unique system that we have here, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia is the functional equivalent of a state Supreme Court for these purposes, for purposes of interpreting a law applicable only in the district. In that context, the only appropriate limiting construction is one that's readily apparent, and one was not here. But briefly, I'd like to address the clause as narrowed by the Court of Appeals. It can mean one of two things. It gives the police power to disperse anybody if they conclude that a threat to the, quote, peace, unquote, of the embassy is present. If that means what it normally means in a domestic breach of the peace context, then the statute's unconstitutional for the reasons that have been set forth in Cox and many other cases. If the term peace is more broadly construed, the way apparently the majority interpreted it here to apply even to peaceful political insults, then a fortiori the power to disperse those is overbroad.
I'd like. Did you ask for rehearing in the Court of Appeals?
No, Mr. Justice, we
did not. And they didn't go to a vote on rehearing sua sponte on their own?
No, Mr. Justice. I'd like, if I might, to save a minute or so for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Patacci. Mr. Schwab, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Congress has reached a constitutionally permissible balance in enacting this statute. The balance is between strong national interests, which support restrictions on demonstrations in the area of foreign embassies, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, the rights of demonstrators who seek to demonstrate at embassies and other property of foreign governments. The restrictions on speech are modest. The only restriction on demonstrations is within the immediate vicinity of foreign embassies, that is, within 500 feet of them. The statute was enacted 50 years ago by Congress. It was enacted because the State Department and the Metropolitan Police Department didn't believe that existing law was adequate to deal with demonstrations that were then being conducted near a number of embassies. It had the strong support of the State Department. Secretary of State Hull requested that the statute be enacted. It was drafted by the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and the statute has been repeatedly upheld in litigation in the lower federal courts of the District of Columbia.
But Congress and the President apparently no longer have any interest in it. Is that right? I mean, it was originally a federal statute, but now it's a D.C. statute, and Congress seems to have, with the approval of the President, seems to have worried about whether it was too broad, and instead of deciding that itself, passed the buck to the D.C. government,
well, Congress
suggesting
has
that they reexamine it.
Congress has delegated this matter to the City Council and has suggested to the Council that it reexamine the statute, but the delegation itself indicates that the obligation of the United States is being performed here in providing protection to these embassies. The statute also indicates that the Council should seek advice from the Secretary of the Treasury and the Secretary of State. And in fact has done that. The Secretary of the Treasury's interest is involved because the Secret Service provides protection to foreign embassies. So we don't believe that there's been any congressional abandonment of national interests here, and certainly the executive has not abandoned this because the executive has been very heavily involved in matters before the Council. Representatives from the State Department and the Department of Justice and the Treasury Department have all testified. They've all submitted written statements. Secretary Shultz has submitted a written statement, which is attached to the government's brief, the U.S. brief in this case. And, of course, they strongly support the statute as amicus curiae here. So we don't feel
it just
that
seems to me a very peculiar way for the federal government to vindicate an assertedly vital federal interest to leave it to a city council to vindicate this enormous this protection for foreign diplomats that's assertedly so important that it warrants the silencing of speech. Have they delegated this to any other city councils in New York or elsewhere?
Well, the principal responsibility for protecting embassies in New York City falls on the New York Police Department. There's federal reimbursement for that, but the New York City Police Department is the agency that primarily protects foreign diplomats who live in New York City.
Could New York adopt a municipal ordinance like this and purport to be vindicating a federal international interest?
Well, New York has adopted procedures that are very similar to 22-1115. We've discussed them in our brief. Those procedures were upheld in litigation. Basically, what's done near the Russian embassy in New York is that there's a bullpen about 120 feet from the Russian embassy there, the embassy to the UN. They let a small number of demonstrators picket in that bullpen, and then any other demonstrations have to take place two or three blocks away from the embassy.
But the federal government hasn't intervened to establish any procedures there. They've left it up to the municipality.
I'm not sure of the extent of their involvement there. I do know that the current Appropriations Act has a $7 million reimbursement to the city of New York for performing these functions. That's the State Department appropriations. We've discussed that briefly in our brief. I'm sorry I can't give you the page number, but it is...
That's for the UN and all that business?
Yes.
Well, that's a whole lot different from there.
Yes, it is different from this because in New York... They are representatives in our country, but they're primarily to an international organization, while in the District of Columbia, the representatives from foreign nations are representatives certified to this government. So there is a bit of a difference here. And we believe that difference would support this statute more strongly.
Federal interest.
I'm sorry?
Does the city have any interest other than that of the federal government in this law?
No, other than the same interest that all citizens have in this country. There is no independent District of Columbia interest here.
But I would... Does the federal government put them up to it?
Well, the federal government didn't enact... I mean, Congress enacted this statute in 1938. Last year, Congress considered amending the statute, and rather than doing that, it delegated that authority to the District of Columbia Council. Now, if the council alters this law, then, of course, anything that they enact would not be effective until after a congressional layover period, and Congress during that period could adopt a joint resolution to alter anything the council does.
Sent a letter.
That's correct.
And told them to do it.
No. The Secretary of State has sent a letter to the Council informing the Council that it believes that strong national interests support the current statute
He told them they should do it, and what are you saying?
The Secretary of State is saying don't change the law.
May I ask, when you refer to the Secretary of State's letter, he indicates it's terribly important to ensure that the United States missions abroad receive reciprocal treatment. Are there any foreign governments that impose a 500-foot buffer zone around our embassies, or any foreign governments that prohibit marching in front of one of our embassies with a hostile sign?
I don't know of any, Your Honor.
Reciprocal treatment would seem to justify the statute.
I don't think that, from what I understand about reciprocal treatment, it's not precise reciprocity. What it is comparable protection.
And, what is the buffer zone in any other foreign country that you're familiar with? Maybe it isn't 500, is it 400?
I'm sorry I can't answer that question.
What about signs? Do any of them prohibit anything similar to signs, flags, parades in front of our embassy?
I'm sorry I can't answer that either. Mr. Nadler, who's representing the United States, may be able to answer that question. But from what I understand, the primary concern with regard to reciprocity, and that's in the declaration of James Nolan, who's chief of foreign, I believe, chief of foreign missions, I believe, from the State Department, is that what the State Department wants is a situation where we provide protection at a substantial level in this country to foreign missions so that these matters can be negotiated with foreign governments, and that where we believe that insufficient security is provided around our embassies elsewhere, we can representatives can meet with representatives of foreign governments and negotiate improved security, and that if we they believe that we can't.
Is it part of our foreign policy to object to hostile signs in front of our embassies?
I know of only. I think that there are such objections. Yes.
Pardon me.
I think there have been such objections.
Tell me the process for the D.C. Council's changing this law. Could it be done by a simple vote of the council? Does that vote have to be approved by the president? Does the president have any?
The process would be for. The president has no involvement.
None at all.
None at all. The council would enact a provision like any other council law. Then that is submitted to the mayor of the District of Columbia. The mayor can either sign or veto. If the mayor vetoes, then it goes back to the council, and they can override by, I believe, a two-thirds vote. Then, if it's signed or veto is overridden, it's submitted to Congress, and then there's a 30-day period. There are, I believe, 30 legislative days, or roughly comparable legislative days, and that the provision sits before Congress, and Congress can then pass a joint resolution of disapproval. Joint resolution would require presidential signature, so the only time the president would ever get involved is where Congress has voted to disapprove or to somehow alter an act of the council. The only presidential involvement that there has been in this whole area is that the president signed the Home Rule legislation, which gave district government its limited home rule.
I suppose there may be some question as to whether he has to sign the disapproval, the congressional disapproval.
There is some question as to whether he has to sign, but I mean, as far as the Constitution is concerned, but I believe the law has been changed so that the only way to disapprove now is by joint resolution, and that a joint resolution requires either a veto or it requires presentment.
Mr. Schwab, is the council considering changes in this statute?
The council has introduced a bill that's very similar to 18 U.S.C. Section 112.
Happened to that?
It has held hearings on the bill. It has heard testimony from many interested organizations in the district. It's heard testimony from the State Department, from the Treasury Department, and from the Department of Justice. And it's received Secretary Shultz's letter. As far as I know, nothing further has occurred after the hearings.
Will it make, Mr. Schwab, if it becomes law?
Well, The primary change that would be made, I think, is that picketing would be permitted. Actions that of demonstrators that affect ingress or egress to embassies would be unlawful. I mean, that impair ingress or egress. Any acts of coercion or intimidation or any threatening action, that would be prohibited by the law. Now, I'm So, well, my time is just about up. I would like to say that we believe the decision of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. We believe it is very soundly reasoned. Now you'll hear from Mr. Kneedler, who will state the interest of the United States. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schwab. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Kneedler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The petitioners in this case lose sight of the fact that the target of the demonstrations in this case is not an organ of domestic government, as has been true in most of the cases that this Court has considered, such as the Edwards case and the Grace case. It concerns the diplomatic representatives of a foreign government and a foreign mission in the seat of government of the United States. And the function of a diplomatic mission such as that is not to either participate in or to be the staging ground for domestic political disputes or controversies within the United States. It has a quite distinct function of carrying on that country's diplomatic mission with the United States government. And as a matter of practice and as a matter of obligation under the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, those dealings with the United States are to be carried on directly with the United States government. And the foreign embassy has an obligation to remain removed from internal affairs of the United States. These considerations set a diplomatic mission in the District of Columbia apart from the domestic political process. In our view, that unique status of diplomatic missions under the Constitution and under the First Amendment means that Congress may interpose what is here a modest geographical separation between the diplomatic representative of a foreign government and persons in the United States who seek to demonstrate against the position of the foreign government. Or as Senator Pittman, the principal sponsor in 1938, put it, all the statute seeks to do is to protect the representatives and the mission from having criticism of their government brought to their attention right in their faces.
But that isn't this statute.
That is the statute, Your Honor.
I thought this was a Act of the District of Columbia.
No, this statute was enacted by Congress in 1938 at a time when there was considerable.
Then it later was dropped, wasn't it?
No, the statute has not been repealed or affected. There was a proposal in 1986 to repeal the statute. In fact, the Senate passed that, but Congress declined to repeal it. What Congress did instead was pass a sense of the Congress resolution and ask the District of Columbia government, the council, to consider whether revisions in the statute might be appropriate. But the statute, as enacted by Congress, remains on the book, and Congress declined to repeal it.
Is it being enforced?
It is being enforced,
yes.
The statute is being enforced.
Who's enforcing it?
The responsibility under the statute resides with the Metropolitan Police Department, that has been true from the outset. The statute, the enforcement of statutes such as this has always been the responsibility of the Metropolitan Police Force. There is no general federal police force in the District of Columbia. The Metropolitan Police Force, even before Home Rule, was the principal entity responsible for these things. The Secret Service does have backup responsibility. The Secret Service is very interested in the statute because of its importance in establishing a security perimeter around embassies. But the day-to-day enforcement, the arrests under it, are made by the police department.
Mr. Kneedler, I confess that I am inclined to view a statute dealing with this subject that's passed by the Congress quite differently from one that's passed, say, by the Omaha City Council, which may desire to protect a consulate in Omaha. I originally thought this was a federal statute. It originally was a federal statute.
And it still is a federal statute.
Well, it is, but when Congress passes I guess what's referred to as the sense of the Congress resolution, but which in effect says to the district government, you decide what to do with this thing. It may well violate the Constitution. Isn't that an expression by Congress that it really is not calling the shots with respect to this anymore and leaving it up to the District of Columbia government?
I think not completely and not finally. First of all, Congress, as Mr. Schwab mentioned, has the responsibility and the authority to review statutes passed by the District of Columbia government. So if this should be repealed or revised, Congress has the authority to overturn that. Secondly, when Congress sent it to the District of Columbia government and in no way disclaimed the important national interests and law of nations interests underlying it, in fact, it recognized that there were security interests and said that they may have to be balanced against other interests. And thirdly, Congress quite specifically said that the D.C. Council should take this into account with the views of the Secretary of State and the Secretary of the Treasury because of their diplomatic and security interests in the matter.
That's certainly an abnegation, at least, of any views by the Congress on the point.
Well, the only
Congress
thing that
is basically saying, you know, we really haven't made the judgment that the international interests require this anymore.
No, what Congress said is we have not made the judgment that the interests that underlie the statute in 1938 are no longer in force. Congress had before it a proposal to repeal this statute and declined to do it. So as far as the law as it now stands, 2211.15 is still on the books as Congress passed it. And the executive branch, the Secretary of State, Secret Service, and the Justice Department have all strongly opposed any reduction
in the... Has the federal government made New York City do anything like this?
Well, the federal government hasn't attempted to do that. What the United States does in New York is to cooperate with the city police in New York in establishing appropriate security perimeters around UN missions up there. But the District of Columbia...
They tried to make New York pass a bill like this?
No, they haven't. They haven't tried, but they're alternative.
Is there any reason why? It's more of it in New York than
Congress. Congress could perhaps enact a nationwide statute. It has so far chosen to concentrate on the seat of government of the United States.
All states ride herd on the district of government. They have the veto power of the district of government.
Well, that's right, and
isn't that the reason?
That's one of the principal reasons, and also as the affidavit of one of the State Department officials in the record says, foreign governments attach particular importance to what happens in the District of Columbia precisely because it is the seat of government of the United States. We have here not simply consulates, but the embassies of foreign governments, which are the symbolic presence of those governments in the United States. And so any violation of the security or dignity of an embassy would have particularly grave consequences as viewed in another nation.
Mr. Kneedler, do you think that the Court of Appeals has the authority to narrow the construction of a D.C. ordinance?
I agree with Justice White. I wouldn't say that it's a narrowing. I would say it's an interpretation of the statute against the background.
Well, think that the Court of Appeals has the authority to narrow the construction of the D.C. ordinance?
Yes. In this case, we agree with the District of Columbia on this point. They have a footnote in their brief in which they say where the statute involved affects important federal interests rather than purely local interests, that the D.C. Court of Appeals does have that authority. And 2211.15 was enacted by Congress to serve important national and international interests. So, yes, we do think that. And in any event, I think this Court has that authority to attach the construction that was given to the second clause by the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Kneedler, can I ask you a question? The two justifications for the statute are security on the one hand and the dignity interest on the other. Do you think the security interest by itself is sufficient to justify the first clause of the statute?
Perhaps not in every application. Certainly the sort of demonstrations that one category of demonstrations Congress was responding to in 1938 involved picketing by 30 or 40 people or even larger demonstrations. I think at that point the security interests coincide with the dignity interests. As if you get down to a single picket, then the security interest may be reduced, although even so, a hostile picket at least carries some potential over and beyond an ordinary pedestrian.
Let me ask the other question then. Do you think the dignity interest by itself would be sufficient to support the first clause?
Yes, I do, and dignity in the...
We don't want to insult our guests when they're invited here on a diplomatic mission.
Well, that is a part of it. The Vienna Convention, to which the United States is a party, requires party states to take appropriate steps to protect the peace of a mission against impairment and to protect the dignity of a mission. Now, appropriate steps is something that depends upon what's appropriate under the laws of that country.
Is the Vienna Convention essential to justify the statute, in your view?
Well, the Vienna Convention simply is a culmination or a codification of a duty to protect the dignity of foreign missions that that antedated it. In fact, when Congress enacted this statute in 1938...
To have a statute that said that at no diplomatic gathering in either the White House or the State Department shall any guest say anything offensive to an ambassador?
I don't know that that would be, I mean, that would obviously raise separate questions. There may be limits.
Isn't that precisely the same question as a person walking in front of the embassy with a sign?
Well, I think Congress may well have that authority it would be quite similar in this unique context to a fighting words sort of statute, which is what we analogize this statute to.
I understand.
Words that are particularly likely to cause offense and something delivered face-to-face, which is the phrase the court used in Chaplinsky.
That's what I'm thinking of, a face-to-face comment to the ambassador. Could we make it a crime to say something unpleasant to the ambassador at a social gathering?
Well, it depends, yes. But again, unpleasant in the way the statutes speak to.
Criticizing his government's policy.
That's right, and that's not far removed from the sort of words that were discussed in Chaplinsky itself, where the court was referring to words that were damn fascist and that sort of thing, spoken word-to-word, or face-to-face. And if Congress can, if a legislature can do that with respect to the two citizens on the street, I think it can surely do that.
So you agree that's the same case as this statute?
Yes. And in this case, we're talking about, I mean, I think this case is even stronger. Here we have a specific diplomatic undertaking in the conventions, and which Congress recognized in 1938, not to protect any insults in the newspaper or anywhere else, but to protect the premises. And that the purposes of this are related to the diplomatic immunities that go back 200 years, which are to enable citizens to, diplomatic personnel to operate with independence and to be free from intimidation and coercion. And this being free from picketing that might undermine the independence of diplomatic personnel is critical to the performance of the diplomatic function.
It wouldn't be violated by someone standing right at the front door and yelling insults.
This statute has been construed not to reach that, although there may be a breach of the peace statute that would separately reach that. I'd like to make several other points in closing. I don't have this much time. With respect to the reciprocity point that Justice Stevens mentioned, at page 14 of our brief, we reproduce a paragraph from the record that explains the importance that the State Department attaches to this statute in urging foreign governments to establish a security perimeter.
Have any established a 500-foot?
Not in the form of statutes, but this is. The Vienna Convention refers to taking appropriate steps, and that can be appropriate in the...
But have any of them taken either of the two appropriate steps, one, a 500-foot buffer zone, or two, no signs in front of the embassy?
Not specifically a 500-foot buffer zone. As this passage recites, the State Department has been successful in establishing some security perimeter, some space in which demonstrations, including signs, cannot occur. So that has happened, and when you determine what's appropriate under the Vienna Convention, it's sensible to take into account the special sensitivity in this country to giving local police too much discretion in deciding how far away a demonstration should be located or how it should be conducted. The court's decision last term in Houston versus Hill is the latest example of a case where the court was concerned about vesting that discretion. This statute, 22.11.15, has the virtue of establishing a clear rule that both the Secret Service and the police can respect, that diplomatic personnel know that they're secure within that 500-foot perimeter, and demonstrators know precisely where the borderline is in terms of what they can do and what they can't. And this statute has been on the books for 50 years and has operated with that 500-foot buffer zone around U.S. embassies in the United States, and it's operated efficiently. And nothing in this court's First Amendment jurisprudence requires that congressional judgment be overturned. There are other examples where the nature of the forum allows these sorts of restrictions. The jails in Adderley, Cox versus Louisiana with respect to picketing near courthouses, are very similar. In fact, Cox rests on a number of the same considerations that underlie 22.11.15, which is the importance, in that case, to protect the judicial function, in this case, to protect the diplomatic function from both real and apparent political pressures and to allow it to function freely without the outside interference that might more appropriately be directed at the political branches of the United States government. And so in our view, as we've set forth in our brief, Cox versus Louisiana is dispositive of this case. I'd also like to say, though, that under this court's decision in Renton, this is not a statute that should be viewed as resting on any judgment by the United States with respect to the viewpoint or the content of what's being said. This is a statute that is not justified on the content, but is instead justified on the content-neutral consequences that would flow from the sorts of demonstrations that the statute is directed to.
District police do not enforce the statute. What does Congress do about that?
Well, Congress certainly has oversight responsibilities over the district police. I'd like to say that the claim, as I understand that petitioners have made, is not that the statute's not being enforced. Arrests are made at the South African embassy. I think they are they're objecting to the possibility of whether prosecutions then go forward, and that issue is not in this case. The panel declined to reach that question.
Thank you, Mr. Needler. Mr. Battacci, you have 1 minute remaining.
Mr. Chief Justice, if I haven't made this clear, I'd like to. The Vienna Convention of 1961 is the only treaty that's implicated here. That is the document that prescribes the international obligation to protect foreign missions. The Congress implemented that treaty in 1972 through 18 U.S.C. 112, which is the nationwide federal statute. That statute prohibits conduct but does not prohibit speech, at least by implication. Congress, in passing a nationwide federal statute, has concluded that the First Amendment doesn't allow it to prescribe speech that's insulting to foreigners. One final point. The District of Columbia has a police line regulation which was upheld by the Court of Appeals in the Cullinane case. It allows the police to remove people from areas, to set up a police line and keep them out of areas when they reasonably believe that's necessary to protect persons and property. That police line regulation would remain standing even if the second clause is stricken, and it would give the District of Columbia police all the authority they legitimately need to protect the persons and property of any foreign governments or foreign officials.
Thank you, Mr. Battacci. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.